Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have now finished the meeting, and the league has not offered a minimum that compensates the recognition that our players deserve. Therefore, there is no agreement, and the strike is still on.
After winning the World Cup, women's soccer players in Spain have gone on strike over pay, as calls grow for the head of Spain's soccer federation to resign after he forcibly kissed Spanish soccer star Jenny Hermoso during the recent World Cup trophy ceremony. We'll look at what's become the Me Too moment for Spanish sports. Then to Mexico, where the Supreme Court has decriminalized abortion at the federal level.
Mexico is an incredibly misogynistic country that still has deeply rooted traditional ideals. Abortion being legal and having a legal context that supports our decisions represents a big change.
And we look at the dire conditions inside the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta, where Donald Trump and his 18 co-defendants were recently booked. 10 prisoners have now died in the jail's custody just this year, the latest on Sunday.
What we see happening in Fulton County is just by entering the jail, some of our inmates are literally being convicted of a death and given a death sentence because of entering into this space.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Joe Biden and leaders of other G20 nations are gathering in India's capital, New Delhi, for a weekend summit that'll focus on international debt, food security, and the climate crisis. Biden is meeting today with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi ahead of the summit. Chinese President Xi Jinping is not attending and has instead sent China's premier to the gathering. Ahead of the summit, the British charity Oxfam accused G20 countries of failing by a wide margin to slash greenhouse gas emissions below levels needed to prevent a climate catastrophe. Those fears were echoed by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres earlier this week at the Africa Climate Summit.
To the large emitters, to the G20 countries responsible for 80% of the emissions that we'll be meeting this week in Delhi, assume your responsibilities. Developed countries must commit to reaching net zero emissions as close as possible to 2040.
In China, remnants of Typhoon Haikui struck Hong Kong Thursday, bringing widespread flooding and triggering landslides. More than 6 inches of rain fell on Hong Kong in less than an hour, the fastest rate of precipitation since records began in 1884. In Brazil, the death toll from a cyclone that brought flash flooding to southern states earlier this week is approaching 40. In the Mediterranean, at least 18 are dead from unprecedented storms that dropped over a year's worth of rain in less than 24 hours over some areas. On Thursday, helicopter crews were dispatched in parts of Greece to rescue residents who were trapped on their rooftops. In the Atlantic, Hurricane Lee has rapidly intensified to become this year's first Category 5 hurricane, with sustained winds of up to 165 miles per hour. Forecasters say Lee will remain north of the Caribbean islands, but could potentially strike the U.S., the Canadian East Coast, or Bermuda late next week. In Hawaii, residents of Maui are marking the one-month anniversary of the devastating wildfire that decimated the historic town of Lahaina. The official death toll is still at 115, with 380 people still missing, as some families are reckoning with the reality that their remains may never be found or identified. In more climate news, a record-breaking post-Labor Day heat wave is continuing to bring extreme weather alerts to tens of millions of people in the U.S. mainland. The record temperatures prompted many school districts to cancel outdoor activities like recess or to switch to online classes for the start of the school year. In Washington, D.C., the high temperature at Dulles International Airport reached triple digits for the first time ever in the month of September.
I think it's not normal. I have lived here for a long time, and this is incredible. Like, we are in September waiting for fall to come, and suddenly it's 100 degrees outside. So it's, I think it has to be with the global warming.
On Thursday, Secret Service officers arrested three climate activists after they tied a banner to the White House fence demanding President Biden declare a climate emergency. The action came ahead of a march to end fossil fuels planned for New York City on September 17th. Here in New York, this week's heat wave was felt by fans and players at the U.S. Open, where temperatures reached the mid-90s, accompanied by intense humidity. Russian player Daniil Medvedev issued a warning during his Wednesday quarterfinals match.
I cannot imagine. One player going to die, and they're going to stay here.
You cannot imagine. One player is going to die, and then they will see, Medvedev said. On Thursday, climate activists with Extinction Rebellion delayed a semifinal tennis match by 50 minutes between Coco Gauff and Karolina Muchova as they stood up in the crowd and called for an end to fossil fuels. One protester glued their bare feet to the ground. 19-year-old Coco Gauff eventually won the match, sending her to the finals. She's the first American teenager to get this far since Serena Williams in 1999. The African-American player was questioned about the protest following her win.
I mean, I think that, you know, throughout history, moments like this are definitely defining moments. I believe climate in climate change. Hey, that's what they felt that they needed to do to get their voices heard, I can't really get upset at it.
Coco Gauff speaking after her win at the U.S. Open. In other news from the U.S. Open, an audience member was thrown out of the stadium Monday after he chanted Deutschland über alles, a phrase associated with Hitler and Nazism, during a match with German player Alexander Zverev. He informed the chair umpire, which led to security ejecting the fan as the crowd applauded. Zverev later said, as a German, I'm not proud of that part of history, and it's not okay to do that, he said. Hundreds of people in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region attended funerals for the 16 people killed by a Russian missile strike on a crowded marketplace Wednesday. The funerals came as a Russian attack on the city of Kryvyi Rih killed at least one person and wounded several others. In Brussels, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said Thursday, Ukrainian forces have been making gradual progress in their counteroffensive against entrenched Russian forces on the southern and eastern fronts.
And they are making progress. Not perhaps as much as we hoped for, but they are gaining ground gradually. Some 100 meters per day.
In August, the New York Times reported the number of Ukrainian and Russian troops killed or wounded in action since Russia's invasion is approaching 500,000. In more news about Ukraine, Elon Musk, the billionaire CEO of internet satellite provider SpaceX, secretly ordered his company to deactivate its Starlink satellites as they passed above Russian-occupied Crimea last year in order to disrupt a Ukrainian sneak attack on the Russian naval fleet. That's according to an excerpt of a soon-to-be-published biography of Elon Musk written by Walter Isaacson, who reports Musk's decision prevented Ukrainian submarine drones from reaching their intended target, Russia's Black Sea fleet. Elon Musk reportedly feared Russia would respond to an attack on Crimea with nuclear weapons. According to Isaacson, Musk said at the time, quote, Starlink was not meant to be involved in wars. It was so people can watch Netflix and chill and get online for school and do good, peaceful things, not drone strikes, he said. North Korea announced its first tactical nuclear-armed submarine as it continues to ramp up its nuclear capabilities. This comes after reports that Kim Jong-un is planning a trip to Russia this month to discuss North Korean military aid for Putin's war in Ukraine, and where Kim could seek technical help for his nuclear and missile programs. In the United States, a federal jury has found former President Trump's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, guilty of contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Navarro, who faces up to 2 years in prison and a $200,000 fine, has promised to appeal all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis has asked a court to help protect members of the special grand jury that indicted Donald Trump and 18 co-conspirators for attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election after a far-right website published their home addresses, phone numbers, and vehicle information. Willis, who is African-American, also had her information doxed online alongside racist and derogatory comments. On Thursday, D.A. Willis sent a letter to U.S. Congressmember Jim Jordan of Ohio, the Republican chair of the House Judiciary Committee, after he announced plans for a congressional probe into her prosecution of Trump and his allies. D.A. Willis wrote, quote, "Your attempt to invoke congressional authority to intrude upon and interfere with an active criminal case in Georgia is flagrantly at odds with the Constitution," unquote. In other news from Georgia, the family of 24-year-old Chandre Delmore is demanding justice for his death after being imprisoned at the Fulton County Jail. Authorities say he died at a hospital in custody Sunday, 3 days after being found unresponsive in his cell. He's the 10th person to die in custody of the notorious Fulton Jail this year. His mother spoke at a news conference Thursday.
I wasn't expecting to see my son in the condition that he was in when I came out here. I thought I would be able to take my son with me back home. But that didn't happen. And I want answers. I want to know what happened to my son.
We'll have more on this segment later in the broadcast. In more news from Georgia, five protesters, at least, were arrested Thursday after they chained themselves to construction equipment at the site of Cop City, a massive $90 million police training complex in Atlanta. The action came in response to the indictment earlier this week of 61 activists on racketeering charges over their involvement in the movement to stop Cop City. Five of them were also indicted on domestic terrorism and arson charges. This is Ayola Omolara Kaplan, an Atlanta artist and one of the Cop City protesters taken into custody Thursday.
We have to stand up and take our own future into our own hands through direct actions like this. We need as many people as possible to join in the fight of nonviolent direct actions. The more of us that are willing to take the risk and come out here and put their bodies on the line to save the forest.
And in Los Angeles, actor Danny Masterson has been sentenced to 30 years to life in prison for raping two women he met through the Church of Scientology. He was convicted earlier this year, though the jury was hung on a third rape charge. The two women, who have not been publicly identified, spoke at Thursday's hearing before the sentence was handed down. One of them addressed Masterson, saying, quote, "When you rape me, you stole from me. That's what rape is, a theft of the spirit," she said. Actor Leah Remini, who's been an outspoken critic of the Church of Scientology since breaking ties with it and was at Masterson's trial supporting the survivors, said in a statement, quote, "I am relieved that this dangerous rapist will be off the streets and I'm able to violently assault and rape women with the help of Scientology, a multi-billion dollar criminal organization with tax-exempt status," she said. Masterson is best known for his role in the sitcom That 70s Show. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Spanish state prosecutors have just filed a complaint against the head of Spain's soccer federation, Luis Rubiales, for sexual assault and coercion after he forcibly kissed Spanish soccer star Jenny Hermoso during the awards ceremony last month after the Spanish soccer team won the Women's World Cup. Earlier this week, Jenny Hermoso filed a sexual assault criminal complaint against Rubiales, who has been temporarily suspended by FIFA. So far, Rubiales has rejected calls to resign. Protesters across Spain have taken to the streets to support Hermoso.
Es un delito. Es acoso sexual.
This is a crime. This is clearly sexual harassment under Spanish law, and not only Spanish law, but also under European law. The Istanbul Convention, signed by Europe in 2011 and ratified by Spain in 2014, considers this as sexual abuse, and it is a crime.
On Tuesday, the Spanish Soccer Federation appointed Montse Tomé to become the first woman to serve as coach of the women's national soccer team. The announcement was made shortly after the federation fired coach Jorge Vilda, who had long faced criticism for his coaching style. Calls for Vilda's resignation grew after he expressed support for Rubiales. Spanish soccer player Veronica Boquete said has become a Me Too moment for the Spanish sports.
I think it's really similar to the Me Too moment. I really think that it's gonna help to the change, because the change is already there. It was already before this World Cup and this incident. We are in a moment of changing, and I think that this can push us as a society a little further and a little faster.
Amid this growing scandal, women's soccer players in Spain have gone on strike in a dispute over pay as calls grow for the head of Spain's Soccer Federation to resign. Again, this in the midst of the sexual assault scandal. The strike began after talks broke down between the Spanish Women's Soccer League and the Players Union over pay and working conditions. According to the union, the minimum pay for women's soccer players in Spain is about $17,000 a year, compared to about $192,000 a year for male players. This is Daphne Fernandez of the Players Union.
We have now finished the meeting, and the league has not offered a minimum that compensates the recognition that our players deserve. Therefore, there is no agreement, and the strike is still on.
We're also now joined by Brenda Elsie, a co-host of the feminist sportscast Burn It All Down, and co-author of Futbolera, Women, Sports, and Sexuality in Latin America, and editor of the book Football and the Boundaries of History. She's also a professor at Hofstra University. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Brenda. It's great to have you with us. Let's start with the absolute top news that was breaking as we went to air, that Spanish state prosecutors have accused Luis Rubiales of sexual assault and coercion for kissing a player on the lips without her consent at the World Cup victory ceremony. So he's now apparently going to be criminally charged after Jenny Hermoso filed a criminal complaint against him. But the world saw what he did. Can you talk about the significance of this moment in Spain and around the world?
I can't think of a moment more significant, really, in my lifetime. This has been incredible, and I'm really, truly sorry that this has happened to such a wonderful player. Jenny Hermoso is a pillar of the women's football community and game. However, I am also very heartened by how much attention this story just won't go away. And that's because it's part of this real, as Veronica Boquete said in the earlier part of your segment, it's part of a huge problem that people have known that they've been working on, and it's crystallized in this moment. And as much as the Spanish Federation wants to say we did not see what we saw what we saw.
Now, talk about the significance of, well, everything right now. You have the first woman to coach the women's soccer team. She had actually quit the team. She had been on the coaching staff, but she quit among a group of other people on the women's soccer staff over Coach Vilda, and demanding a complete change in coaching. And now she has been brought back to lead the team.
It's incredibly significant, and I think it shows two really important and exciting changes and progress. And one is the organization of women athletes as workers. The labor union has been huge and key in continuing to press this issue with the federation, and so that has been incredibly important. And the other aspect to this, of course, is that look, I mean, the Spanish Federation wants to make sure that no structural changes really happen. And so this coaching is important. It's an important change. Everyone knew it had to happen. But they really need to have an institutional shakeup, not only in the Spanish Federation, but in FIFA. And we know this. So I think it's important to remember that, you know, it's not insignificant that you change a coach. It is very important. But at the same time, there needs to be independent governing bodies within global football that can respond to these like widespread harassment, not only of women, but also of youth players.
Spain's acting Minister of Culture and Sport, Miguel Iceta, has voiced his support for Jenni Hermoso's criminal complaint against Rubiales. Last week, Iceta also backed calls for gender equity and more women leadership in Spain's soccer federation, saying the shift in culture would be enforced under a new sporting law in Spain.
Se acabó cualquier discriminación a las mujeres, cualquier obstáculo en el deporte.
It's over. No more discrimination for women. No more obstacles for women in sport. It's over. It's over, and unfortunately, that happened because of an incident that should not have taken place. We are witnessing a real social and sporting backlash, which will make this a better country.
And this is Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sánchez. He's acting now.
It is true that there has been some behavior, in this case, that of Mr. Rubiales, which shows that in our country, there's still a long way to go in terms of equality and respect and the equalization of rights between women and men.
So this is very interesting. Even the prime minister cannot have him fired. And this has been the issue. I mean, they fired the coach who supported Rubiales, though he had so many other issues. But they couldn't get rid of Rubiales. And another fascinating aspect of this is that in Spain, across the political spectrum, something like three quarters of the population is demanding his ouster. And let me just say, in this latest news of him being criminally charged, he faces something like 1 to 4 years in jail and a fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's layers of bureaucracy here in terms of where this football governance lies. And I would say it's labyrinthine on purpose. The idea that, you know, is the more confusing it is, the less accountable people can be. And so it is going to take efforts by people outside of football to hold him accountable. And that has happened also in places like Argentina, where they also went to the Ministry of Gender, and the criminal courts in Colombia, where the women minors on the U.S. or I'm sorry, on the Colombian women's national team went to criminal court over a sexual assault within the federation. So this has happened again and again. They have to go outside of the structures. Rubiales cannot represent the Spanish Federation at this point. He is suspended by FIFA, but it will need to take the course of the investigation, according to FIFA. You can shrug your shoulders, but if anyone paid attention since 2015, FIFA has found a way to avoid responsibility in many cases, both of corruption, embezzlement, and also in terms of gender discrimination. So those things are tied together, I think.
I mean, if you can talk about the federation first going after Jenni Hermoso, even threatening to sue her, accusing her of lying and defamation. Now the federation attempting to distance itself he is about to be criminally charged.
It is just shocking. They are morally bankrupt. They have been for a long time. If they had listened to women, you know, for the last 8 years to the players, this wouldn't have had to happen. But they absolutely refused to make any changes. And this is what has happened. The fact that they have patterns of abusive and bullying and there's such patterns of abuse that you can see, whether it's she said, he said, whether it's you didn't see what you thought you saw, all of this defaming her character. This is classic behavior of predators beyond sport. And so we can see this all play out, and it happens every day to people and we don't see it. But football gives us this window onto how abusers behave.
And if you can talk further about the level of abuse against women soccer players, and even just talking about what we're seeing now, instead of them being in a stadium of tens of thousands being celebrated, the women's soccer players have chosen not to play, to go on strike, because their minimum pay is $17,000 a year, compared to male soccer players in Spain. Minimum pay is something like $192,000 a year. And the women are the soccer stars. They just won the World Cup.
And I hate to tell you, but that's probably one of the highest paid salaries of a women's football player in the world. If you look at the minimum salary of the NWSL in the United States, you will also find it quite shocking. So it is a pervasive problem. FIFPro, the International Players Union, came out with a report right before the World Cup to document all the salary disparities that have gone on in global football. And it is quite shocking. I mean, a soccer star like Marta never was able to play in her home country of Brazil because they've been unwilling to establish a profitable, steady women's league. Even though there's the audience there, of course, and the talent and the facilities and everything. So it is just abject sexism. It's with kind of the argument of the Federation about markets and things like that. But we know that they've actually engineered it to make sure that that market doesn't thrive by doing things like not selling women's jerseys, by not really creating sound contracts where women's soccer can be seen. That pay disparity is not surprising to me, but again, it's part of this really wide spectrum of neglect. It ranges from neglect to abuse of women's soccer. I bet there was not one single federation at the Women's World Cup this year that would say that they were truly happy with their federation and felt supported.
Before we conclude, you mentioned in a previous answer that there are problems, particularly with young players being abused. Explain, Brenda Elsie.
Well, there's not many protections for minors. And we saw with Yenny Hermoso, an incredibly established player, that there was no possibility for consent on that platform. The highest ranking official in her sport, in her country, was able to harm her that way. And we have youth divisions in every single federation, and they have complained about harassment, abuse, labor abuse, whether it's boys being housed in Brazil that have unsafe conditions that lead to fires and sometimes even deaths, like we saw in Flamengo, or whether it's, you know, underage girls, minors that have had sexual abuse, like in the case of Colombia. So I see it as a really wide problem. I think these Spanish women are tremendously courageous, and I think that will benefit all of this system ultimately, so long as we're keeping these men's feet to the fire.
You mentioned Colombia, Brenda. Earlier this year, you wrote about the crisis that's embroiled the Colombian women's national soccer team and the federation with multiple reports of sexual harassment and violence against women and girl players. Can you talk about this before we wrap?
Yeah, unfortunately, despite how wonderful the Colombian women's national team played, they have not been able to, better their conditions. And Ramon Jesurun, who is the head of the Colombian Federation and also a vice president of FIFA, so part of the person that would be deciding on Rubiales, himself has been under investigation both for financial improprieties, but also there has been convictions of coaches of the under-17 team, and yet this person has stayed in power. He's not only is he in power, but he's there to help people like Rubiales. So the Colombian Federation has very similar issues. What is exciting about the Spanish case is we're seeing all kinds of solidarity movements throughout the world, really, for Yenny Hermoso. So I hope it can translate into structural change now.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And of course, we'll continue to follow all of this. Brenda Elsie, co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down, and co-author of Futbolera, Women, Sports and Sexuality in Latin America, and editor of the book Football and the Boundaries of History. Also professor at Hofstra University, where she's co-director of the Latin American Caribbean Studies Program. And if you haven't left us, I just have to ask you one last question about Coco Gauff. If you were following what happened at the U.S. Open, you had the protesters delaying her game by 50 minutes, demanding an end to fossil fuel. Coco Gauff wins. She becomes the youngest to go into the finals, an African-American tennis player, youngest since Serena Williams, like 21 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in her final comments, she actually supported the protesters. She said, even if it did jeopardize